understand or care. Save him? They haven't saved him. They've damned him. Then Lev realizes something. He realizes that he can use this entire situation to his advantage. "My name's Lev," he says, trying to play it as cool as he can. "Pleased to meet you, Lev," says the girl. "I'm Risa, and this is Connor." Connor throws her a dirty look, making it clear that she gave him their real names. Not a good idea for hostage takers, but then most criminals are stupid like that. "Didn't mean for you to take the trank bullet," Connor tells him, "but the cop was a bad shot." "Not your fault," says Lev, even though every bit of it is Connor's fault. Lev thinks about what happened and says, "I would never have run from my own tithing." That much Lev knows is true. "Good thing I was around then," says Connor.
"Yeah," says Risa. "If it wasn't for Connor running across that highway, I'd probably be unwound by now, too."
There's a moment of silence, then Lev, biting back his anger and revulsion, says,
"Thank you. Thank you for saving me."
"Don't mention it," says Connor. Good. Let them think he's grateful. Let them think they're earning his trust. And once they're lulled into their own false sense of security, he'll make sure they both get exactly what they deserve. 7. Connor. Connor should have kept the juvie cop's gun, but he wasn't thinking. He was so freaked out at having tranked a cop with his own weapon, he just dropped it and ran, just as he dropped his backpack on the interstate so he could carry Lev. His wallet with all his money was in that pack. Now he has nothing but pocket lint. It's late now, or, more accurately, early, almost dawn. He and Risa had kept moving through the woods all day, as best they could with Connor having to carry an unconscious tithe. Once night fell, he and Risa had taken turns keeping watch while the other slept. Connor knows that Lev can't be trusted. That's why Connor tied him to the tree. But there's no reason to trust this girl who had come running out of a bus either. It's only their common goal of staying alive that binds them. The moon has left the sky now, but there's a faint glow promising a quick arrival of dawn. By now, their faces would be everywhere. Have you seen these teens? Do not approach. Considered extremely dangerous. Call the police immediately. Funny how Connor had wasted so much time in school trying to convince people he was dangerous. But when it came down to it, he was never sure if he was all that dangerous at all. A danger to himself, maybe. All the while, Lev watches him. At first, the boy's eyes had been lazy, and his head lolling to one side. But now those eyes are sharp. Even in the dimness of the dying fire, Connor can see them. Chilly blue. Calculating. This kid is an odd bird. Connor's not quite sure what's going on planet Lev, and not quite sure he wants to know.
"That bite's gonna get infected if you don't take care of it," Lev says.
Connor looks to the spot on his arm where Lev bit him, still puffy and red. He had tuned the pain out until Lev reminded him.
"I'll deal with it."
Lev continues to study him.
"Why are you being unwound?"
Connor doesn't like the question for a whole lot of reasons. "You mean why was I being unwound? Because, as you can see, I'm not being unwound anymore."
"They will if they catch you."
Connor feels like punching that smug look off the kid's face, but he restrains himself. He didn't rescue the kid just to beat him up. "So what's it like?" Connor asks. "Knowing all your life you're going to be sacrificed?" He meant it as a jab, but Lev takes the question seriously.
"It's better than going through life without knowing your purpose."
Connor's not sure if that was intentionally meant to make him squirm. As if his life has no purpose. It makes him feel like he's the one tied to a tree, not Lev. "I guess it could be worse," says Connor. "We could have all ended up like Humphrey Dunphy." Lev seems surprised by the mention of the name.
"You know that story? I thought they only told it in my neighborhood."
"Nah," says Connor. "Kids tell it everywhere."
"It's made up," says Risa, having just woken up.
"Maybe," says Connor.
But there was this one time a friend and I tried to find out about it while surfing one of the school's computers. We hit this one website that talked about it and how his parents went all psycho. Then the computer crashed. Turns out we were hit by a virus that wiped out the entire district server. Coincidence? I don't think so. Lev's taken in, but Risa, fairly disgusted, says, "Well, I'll never end up like Humphrey Dunphy, because you have to have parents for them to go psycho, and I don't." She stands up. Connor looks away from the dying fire to see that dawn has arrived. "If we're going to keep from being caught, then we should change direction again," Risa says. "We should also think about disguising ourselves."
"Like how?" asks Connor.
"I don't know. Change our clothes first. Haircuts, maybe. They'll be looking for two boys and a girl. Maybe I can disguise myself as a boy."
Connor takes a good look at her and smiles. Risa's pretty. Not in the way Ariana was pretty. In a better way. Ariana's prettiness was all about makeup and pigment injections and stuff. Risa has a natural kind of beauty. Without thinking, Connor reaches out to touch her hair and gently says, "I don't think you could ever pass for a guy."
Then suddenly he finds his hand tugged behind him. His whole body spins around and she painfully wrenches his arm up the small of his back. It hurts so much he can't even say, "Ouch." All he can say is, "Ah, ah, ah." "Touch me again and your arm gets ripped off," Risa tells him. "Got that?"
Yeah, fine, hands off, got it."
Over at the oak tree, Lev laughs, apparently pleased to see Connor in pain. She lets him go, but his shoulder still throbs.
"You didn't have to do that," Connor says, trying not to show how much it still hurts.
"It's not like I was going to hurt you or anything."
"Yeah, well, now you won't for sure," says Risa, maybe sounding a bit guilty for being so harsh.
"Don't forget I lived in a state home."
Connor nods. He knows about stay-ho kids. They have to learn to take care of themselves real young, or their lives are not very pleasant. He should have realized she was a touch-me-not.
"Excuse me," says Lev, "but we can't go anywhere if I'm tied to a tree."
Still, Connor doesn't like that judgmental look in Lev's eyes. "How do we know you won't run?"
"You don't. But until you untie me, I'm a hostage," Lev says. "Once I'm free, I'm a fugitive, like you. Tied up, I'm the enemy. Cut loose, I'm a friend."
"If you don't run," says Connor. Risa impatiently begins untying the vines.
"Unless we want to leave him here, we'll have to take that chance."
Connor kneels to help, and in a few moments, Lev is free. He stands and stretches, rubbing his shoulder where the trank bullet had hit him. Lev's eyes are still blue ice and hard for Connor to read, but he's not running. "Maybe," thinks Connor, "he's over the duty of being tithed. Maybe he's finally starting to see the sense of staying alive."
8. Risa.
Risa finds herself unsettled by the food wrappers and broken bits of plastic they start coming across in the woods, because the first sign of civilization is always trash. Civilization means people who could recognize them if their faces have been smeared on the news net. Risa knows that staying completely clear of human contact is an impossibility. She has no illusion about their chances or their ability to remain unseen. As much as they need to remain anonymous, they cannot get by entirely alone. They need the help of others.
"No, we don't."
Connor is quick to argue as the signs of civilization grow around them. It's not just trash now, but the mossy remnants of a knee-high stone wall, and the rusty remains of an old electrical tower from the days when electricity was transmitted by wires.
"We don't need anyone. We'll take what we need."
Risa sighs, trying to hold together a patience that is already worn through.
"I'm sure you're very good at stealing, but I don't think it's a good idea."
Connor appears insulted by the insinuation.
"What do you think? People are just going to give us food and whatever else we need out of the goodness of their hearts?"
"No," says Risa. "But if we're clever about it instead of rushing into this blind, we'll have a better chance." Her words, or maybe just her intentionally condescending tone, makes Connor storm off.
Risa notices Lev watching the argument from a distance.
If he's going to run, thinks Risa, now's the time for him to do it, while Connor and I are busy fighting.
And then it occurs to her that this is an excellent opportunity to test Lev, and see if he really is standing by them now, or biding his time until he can escape.
Don't you walk away from me,
she growls at Connor, doing her best to keep the argument alive, all the while keeping an eye on Lev to see if he bolts.
I'm still talking to you.
Connor turns toward her. Who says I have to listen?
You would if you had half a brain, but obviously you don't.
Connor moves closer until he's deeper into her airspace than she likes anyone to get.
If it wasn't for me, you'd be on your way to harvest camp, he says.
Risa raises a hand to push him back, but his hand shoots up faster, and he grabs her wrist before she can shove him. This is the moment Risa realizes she's gone too far. What does she really know about this boy? He was going to be unwound. Maybe there's a reason for it. Maybe a good reason. Risa is careful not to struggle, because struggling gives him the advantage. She lets her tone of voice convey all the weight.
Let go of me.
Why?
Exactly what do you think I'll do to you? This is the second time you've touched me without permission,
Risa says. Still, he does not let go. Yet she does notice his grip isn't all that threatening. It isn't tight, it's loose. It isn't rough, it's gentle. She could easily pull out of it with a simple flick of her wrist. So why doesn't she? Risa knows he's doing this to make a point. But what the point is, Risa isn't sure. Is he warning her that he can hurt her if he wants to? Or maybe his message is in the gentle nature of his grip, a way of saying he's not the hurting type.
Well, it doesn't matter, thinks Risa. Even a gentle violation is a violation.
She looks at his knee. A well-placed kick could break his kneecap.
I could take you out in a second, she threatens.
If he's concerned, he doesn't show it.
I know.
Somehow he also knows that she won't do it. That the first time was just a reflex. If she were to hurt him a second time, though, it would be a conscious act. It would be by choice.
Step off, she says.
Her voice now lacks the force it had only moments before. This time he listens and lets go, moving back to a respectable distance. They both could have hurt one another, but neither of them did. Risa isn't quite sure what that means. All she knows is that she feels angry at him for such a mixture of reasons she can't sort them out. Then, suddenly, a voice calls to them from the right.
This is very entertaining and all, but I don't think fighting is going to help much.
It's Lev, and Risa realizes that her little ruse has backfired. She had set out to test him with a fake argument, but the argument turned real, and in the process she completely forgot about Lev. He could have taken off, and they would not have known until he was long gone. Risa throws Connor an evil look for good measure, and the three of them continue on. It isn't until 10 minutes later, when Lev goes off to relieve himself in private, that Connor talks to Risa again.
Good one, Connor says. It worked. What?
Connor leans closer and whispers.
The argument. You put it on to see if Lev would run when we weren't paying attention, right?
Risa is bowled over.
You knew that?
Connor looks at her a bit amused.
Well, yeah.
If Risa felt uncertain about him before, it's even worse now. She has no idea what to think.
So, everything that happened back there was all a show?
Now it's Connor's turn to be unsure.
I guess, sort of, wasn't it?
Risa has to hold back a smile. Suddenly, she's feeling strangely at ease with Connor. She marvels at how that could be. If their argument had been entirely real, she'd be on her guard against him. If it had been entirely a show, she'd be on guard too, because if he could lie so convincingly, she'd never be able to trust him. But this was a mixture of both. It was real, it was pretend, and that combination made it all right. It made it safe. Like performing death-defying acrobatic tricks above a safety net. She holds on to that unexpected feeling as the two of them catch up with Lev, and moved toward the frightening prospect of civilization. Part 2. Storked.
You can't change laws without first changing human nature, Nurse Greta.
You can't change human nature without first changing the law,
Nurse Yvonne. 9. Mother. The mother is 19, but she doesn't feel that old. She feels no wiser, no more capable of dealing with this situation than a little girl. When, she wonders, did she stop being a child? The law says it was when she turned 18, but the law doesn't know her. Still aching from the trauma of delivery, she holds her newborn close. It's just after dawn on a chilly morning. She moves now through back alleys. Not a soul around. Dumpsters cast angular black shadows. Broken bottles everywhere. This, she knows, is the perfect time of day to do this. There's less of a chance that coyotes and other scavengers would be out. She couldn't bear the thought of the baby suffering needlessly. A large green dumpster looms before her, listing crookedly on the uneven pavement of the alley. She holds the baby tight, as if the dumpster might grow hands and pull the baby into its filthy depths. Maneuvering around it, she continues down the alley. There was a time, shortly after the Bill of Life was passed, that dumpsters such as that would be tempting to girls like her. Desperate girls who would leave unwanted newborns in the trash. It had become so common that it wasn't even deemed newsworthy anymore. It had become just a part of life. Funny, but the Bill of Life was supposed to protect the sanctity of life. Instead, it just made life cheap. Thank goodness for the Storking Initiative, that wonderful law that allows girls like her a far better alternative. As dawn becomes early morning, she leaves the alleys and enters a neighborhood that gets better with each street she crosses. The homes are large and inviting. This is the right neighborhood for storking. She chooses the home shrewdly. The house she decides on isn't the largest, but it's not the smallest either. It has a very short walkway to the street, so she can get away quickly, and it's overgrown with trees, so no one either inside or out will be able to see her as she storks the newborn. She carefully approaches the front door. No lights are on in the home yet. That's good. There's a car in the driveway. Hopefully that means they're home. She gingerly climbs the porch steps, careful not to make a sound, then kneels down, placing the sleeping baby on the welcome mat. There are two blankets wrapped around the baby, and a wool cap covers its head. She makes the blankets nice and tight. It's the only thing she's learned to do as a mother. She considers ringing the bell and running, but she realizes that would not be a good idea. If they catch her, she's obliged to keep the baby. That's part of the Storking Initiative, too. But if they open the door and find nothing but the child, it's finders keepers in the eyes of the law. Whether they want it or not, the baby is legally theirs. From the time she learned she was pregnant, she knew she would end up storking this baby. She had hoped that when she finally saw it, looking up at her so helplessly, she might change her mind. But who was she kidding? With neither the skill nor the desire to be a mother at this point in her life, storking had always been her best option. She realizes she's lingered longer than is wise. There's an upstairs light on now, so she forces herself to look away from the sleeping newborn and leaves. With the burden now lifted from her, she has sudden strength. She now has a second chance in life, and this time she'll be smarter. She's sure of it. As she hurries down the street, she thinks how wonderful it is that she can get a second chance. How wonderful it is that she can dismiss her responsibility so easily. 10. Risa. Several streets away from the storked newborn, at the edge of a dense wood, Risa stands at the door of a home. She rings the bell, and a woman answers in her bathrobe. Risa offers the woman a big smile.
Hi, my name is Dee Dee, and I'm collecting clothes and food for our school. We're, like, giving them to the homeless, and it's like this competition. Whoever gets the most wins a trip to Florida or something. So it would be really, really great if you could help out.
The sleepy woman tries to get her brain up to speed with Dee Dee, airhead for the homeless. The woman can't get a word in edgewise because Dee Dee talks way too fast. If Risa had had a piece of chewing gum, she would have popped a bubble somewhere in there to add more authenticity.
Please, please, pretty please, I'm like in second place right now.
The woman at the door sighs, resigned to the fact that Dee Dee isn't going away empty-handed, and sometimes the best way to get